Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in History. I'm your host, Yorgos Giannakopoulos. Today, I'm very thrilled to have Oded Steinberg, who to discuss his new book on race, nation, history, Anglo-German thought in the Victorian era. Well, Oded, I'll leave you to introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll get started with the book.
Well, thank you very much for hosting me today. As George said, clearly, I'm discussing my new book, on which is entitled Race, Nation, History, Anglo-German Thought in the Victorian Era. It came out this August, 2019, in Penn University Press. It's based actually on my PhD or DPhil work at Oxford. This was work being done four years ago. Since then, I've been a postdoctorate in several positions. In Germany as well as in Israel, and now I'm establishing the Hebrew University of Israel as a lecturer beginning from next year. My current work is actually a postdoctorate at the Ben Gurion University of the Negev in a project on actually the Armenian massacres and the British response. Thank you, George.
Excellent. Thank you, Oded. Let's start by breaking down the title, if you will. There's a lot to unpack in the title, I think. Race, Nation, History, Anglo-German Thought in the Victorian Era. Well, let me start by asking you, what drove you to the study of Anglo-German thought? And also the Victorian period. Why? What is it there that your book that you find interesting in the process of writing the book?
Well, it's a very good question, because it also involves, of course, biographical notions, my own biography as well. But I must say that before breaking the title, sometimes we come across things or our research in a very, by accidents, by mere accidents. I think this was the case here. I was very much interested in 19th century periodizations, perceptions of the past, but also actually 20th century periodizations. So, how do historians divide historical times? And I came across, of course, works by Peter Brown and others late in the 20th century. And then I said, okay, this thing's very interesting. Let me start by going back with the theme. So I presented my, before coming to Oxford, so I sent my DPhil project, and back in the time it was very big. So it included 19th and 20th century perceptions among British, German, and French scholars. But once I came to Oxford, I was becoming aware of a whole archival material that is actually based in England about these associations between German and English scholars. And I think this is how, for the first time, I said, okay, there's something here very interesting, because it involves intellectual history, but also social history, because there are social connections between these figures, between these scholars. There's a whole networks here. And then I said, okay, let me see how the theme of time is really being developed by this protagonist. I work this way. I first of all saw who is really writing interestingly about the theme of periodization, and then I saw that they're actually connected in this Anglo-German network, which is evolved around the idea of what I could call racial time. So it's basically dividing time according to racial factors or themes. This is like the main thing, I think, that brought me into this subject.
Right. So on the one end, we have the book is essentially a reflection on the theme of race, nation, and time. And on the other end, it's a recovery of intellectual networks based on specific scholars that you write, right? And exactly. Right. So let me start with the broader theme, race and time. And if you wanted, I would invite you to offer some further thoughts on what you call racial time. Mm-hmm. What is it that happens in 19th century and in the Victorian era that is that sets forth this notion of racial time?
I would say this. It's mainly, first of all, there's two angles, or I would say really big spectrums that are evolving here. First of all, there's this disciplinary development of faculties. So there's starting to be divisions between history, anthropology, ethnology, even one could say scientific, religious, scientific studies and so on. So this is one thing that really, the professionalization, I would say, of history is one aspect which is very central in the 19th century. Another really central theme or development is, of course, the scientific revolution, or I would say the Darwinian revolution of the late 1850s and 1860s. It really brings the notion of race, or gives the notion of race, a more scientific aura. Or layers. Now, this thing, together with what you can call, which is an earlier revolution, but the whole Aryan revolution, or philological revolution of late 18th century with William Jones, and then figures like Schlegel and Blumenbach, and especially Max Müller, who is a prominent figure in my book, who comes to England and actually joins the Teutonic circle of scholars or Anglo-German scholarship. Well, this philological, I would say, revolution, together with the Darwinian revolution and the institute, the professionalization, I would say, of disciplines, these are three aspects that really bring the whole notion of scientific racial time another criteria. Now, Kozelek referred to these things, of course, as the acceleration, the end of the 18th century. And he noticed a very interesting thing, because once we started to, the professionalization of history comes into action and things become faster, then also much more divisions or concrete divisions between historical times. So basically, the whole 19th century, these two objects of periodization together with race are coming together and being more under, I would say, definite definitions. Now, when I say definite definitions, this does not mean that the concept of race or periodization is not fluid. It is still, as I also argue in my book, very much fluid. So on the one hand, we have this kind of institutions, faculty institutions, and more definitions of time, concrete definitions of periodization, so on. But on the other hand, there's still fluidity there. So sometimes race is a very loaded term, because sometimes it means still nation, culture, or even language. And sometimes it has this scientific aspect. So there's a lot of composites, and sometimes even, I would say, contradicting themes here, but I try to bring it together. I think the concept of racial time really brings this idea of periodization, of divisions of history into periods, and the idea of race together. And many of these figures, even most of them, think in this time or in this way on history. So they see history as a sort of long durée of racial battle, even. It's a sort of new, one could say, a clash of civilizations, 19th century style.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And on this, could you elaborate a bit more on what on the identity of the key figures of your study in Britain and in Germany? Your main protagonist.
Of course. So I would say it's a very, the best thing to remember this is sort of a genealogical link, because there is, it's like a family of scholars, one could say. Actually, it's also a family in the sense that some of them are also related through marriages and so on. But in general, we have the one could say, the Urvater. So there's early connections between Thomas Arnold, historian, the father of Matthew Arnold, and the famous classicist, Roman historian, Niebuhr. This is, I would say, the founding members of the Anglo-German scholarship connection. And they are, both of them are very much also involved in, I would say, state matters or even education matters. In the case of Niebuhr, he's an ambassador to Rome, but also a very prominent figure in German scholarship of the early 19th century. And Thomas Arnold, of course, is an educationalist and the founder of the Rugby School. Now, these figures are actually, I would say, the first layer of this whole circle. And then we have the next phase of scholars who are also in touch. So Arnold, Thomas Arnold and Niebuhr meet together, and Arnold is fascinated by Germany. He is fascinated by the Teutonic idea, an idea that basically means that the forefathers of both Germany and England, and I would say England here, of course, and not Britain, because that's a totally different aspect or layer of understanding, are basically the common Anglo-Saxons, or in this case, the common Teutonic Germanic tribes. And this whole Germanic tribes, this is what is the thematic issue that brings all these figures together. And then the next layer is actually Baron Bunsen, who's a very close associate of Niebuhr. He's also his helper or his advisor in Rome, as in the Vatican, where Niebuhr is ambassador. Bunsen comes later as an ambassador to England, ambassador of Prussia, and he brings with him later Max Müller. So if you want, there is a grandfather, which is Niebuhr, a father, which is Bunsen, and an enkelkind or a grandchild, which is Max Müller. And on the other end, or say the English side, we have Thomas Arnold, who's very influential about a whole series of English scholars, especially in the mid-century. The most prominent is maybe, or the most prominent among them are Edward Augustus Freeman, who's a later religious professor in the end of his life, but during most of his life, he's a man of letters. We have also William Stubbs, who's a religious professor of modern history in Oxford. And we also have, and it's exactly, the Teutonic affinity is a very sort of vague theme, but another member of the group is James Bryce, who's actually Scottish or Presbyterian Scot. But he's also among figures. But there's a whole chain, I would say, of around 20 to 30 figures, who all of them actually held connections through correspondence, but also through thematic themes. A very interesting notion to recollect upon is this marriage linkages between them. So, for instance, Max Müller is married to Charles Kingsley's niece. Now, Charles Kingsley, during the 1860s, he's of course a famed Victorian author. Water Babies, of course, is one of his most famed creations. But Charles Kingsley is also responsible as religious professor of modern history in Cambridge in the 1860s to a very prominent, I would say, even influential in the sense of its public appearance, essay by the name of Roman and Teuton. Now, Max Müller is married to him, to his niece. And he's also, Max Müller also defends Charles Kingsley's works. So all these connections, there's personal connections between all of these figures. They have this correspondence, vast correspondence. The book deals with this vast correspondence, I think, for the first time ever, with a very sort of unique group of figures. It's not that no one ever wrote about them. they did. But I don't think no one ever cracked these social intellectual links, and also the overarching theme of this mixture between race and periodization that they all fixed upon. And each one of them has actually a unique but also similar idea of divisions of time, of racial time, if you want.
Yes, thank you. Yes, and I want to get there just to again point out, as you did, the closely knit world of elite institutions in Britain and elsewhere, and how the connections are not simply intellectual, they're also life connections as well. English figures you discuss in the book, namely Bryce, Bury, Freeman, you note in the book that they share a certain perception of history and time in the sense that for them, they're believers in a certain idea of history being in unity, in unison. Can you elaborate further on that? What is it that holds them together? What kind of understanding of historical time do we have here in with regard to your British and English sources?
Yes, of course. So I would say the idea of the unity of history is a phrase that is being brought for the first time by Thomas Arnold, who, as I just mentioned, was, one could say, the forefather of all this Teutonic Circle, together with Niebuhr on the German side. Now, this idea of unity of history basically claims that there's only longer historical periods. So there's one historical period, which is divided into certain subdivisions. Now, these definitions, must not say, or these themes are not, I would say they're very composite. They're full of contradictions as well. But in general, because even amongst one writer, the one could say many ideas about how he sees time or historical time. But in general, these figures, or most of them at least, had this idea of a long historic line divided to sub-periods. Let's, for instance, focus on Edward Augustus Freeman, or E.A. Freeman. Mm-hmm. Now, I think his idea is a clear example of what I call as racial time. Yeah, he has a design of unity of time divided to sub-periods. Now, these sub-periods, I would say, are one time is related to the Aryan race. So it's the whole historical time is divided by racial definitions. So there's a whole Aryan racial time. And this is going against, one could say, the Semitic time. So this kind of subdivision started before even the appearance of clashes in the 19th century or even the Middle Ages. They started, for instance, in the Punic Wars, where Carthago is fighting against Rome. According to Freeman, for instance, this is one of the epic first battles between the two races. Okay, so and these clashes between the races, this is actually what divides the historical time. So another time where a very big clash will happen is only in the 7th century AD, when, of course, the Arabs, Muslims, starting their invasions from the Middle East and starting to expand, actually, and they clash, of course, with the Aryan race. So it's this kind of war of Semitic and Aryan races. If you want, it's a very long array of historical time. Another clash will be later in the 19th, especially in the 19th century, but even before, of course, from the 15th century, between the Ottomans and the Christian world, the Christian Aryan world. Now, of course, one could claim the Ottomans or the Turks are not exactly Semitic. They're Turinian, and Turinian is definition that or category that's been brought to the table in the mid-century by figures like Bunsen and Max Müller, and this refers to the whole people who live in Tur, in the Asian plateau. But again, they are a different racial category. So basically, these clashes of between the races is what divide the big stretch of time into subdivisions. This is a very prominent example of Freeman, who's, one of the protagonists of the book of this kind of claim of racial time. But I must say there are other examples as well. For instance, James Bryce. Now, James Bryce, as I stated before, he was a Scottish Presbyterian Scott, very much akin to also Teutonic ideas, but he's not fervent Teutonic like Freeman. He's a bit more mild, I must say. And this is a differentiation that I bring in the book. But Rice, in profession, he's a lawyer. Or I would say he's a professor for civil law. He's actually the founder of civil law in Oxford. And he divides between the civil law and history back in the beginning of the 1870s. Now, Bryce sees in his very successful, but I would say, must say, neglected book today, The History of the Holy Roman Empire, a book that was first published in 1864. There, Bryce brings a long durée of, I would say, constitutional history, beginning by Roman Teutonic notions that are embedded in the Holy Roman Empire, but are beginning already in the time of Julius Caesar and Augustus. So Bryce, in the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire, has a long durée of Caesars, beginning with Augustus and Caesar and Augustus, and stretching until 1804-06. So according to him, there's a whole almost 2,000 years of long history, which is an enduring existence of a sort of Romano-Teutonic constitutional law that is also reflecting a historical endurance. What is interesting in this case, that in the first editions, before 1871 or the unification of Germany, the line broke in 1804-06, depends on how you see the end of the Holy Roman Empire. But then after the unification, he brings the list back and he says that Germany is actually the continuance of this sort of long stretch of historical endurance. By the way, The History of the Holy Roman Empire, and just to give you a glimpse about the success of the book, was sold in multiple editions, and it's used to be a very, very popular book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And there's current scholarship that sort of aims to place the sort of reconstruction you do on the intellectual side of things, i.e. the ideas about Teutonism, and see how scholars like Bryce, like Freeman and others understand international politics and imagine Britain's place in the world. Does your book touch on this, or how do you see this sort of strain of scholarship that tries to project these kinds of questions on their understanding of international affairs, international relations, etc.?
This is an excellent question. And I think, of course, Duncan Bell deals with this a lot in his work on Seeley as well, a religious professor in Cambridge. But I would start by stating that Freeman has a very famous saying that is actually debated in the research, whether it was him who stated this saying or not. The conclusion, the latest conclusion, and I tend to agree, following an essay I read in Notes and Queries, or a little short essay I read in Notes and Queries, is that actually his saying says that history is past politics and politics are present history. And I think in this sense, all these figures are very involved in the world. They're active diplomats, journalists. For instance, Freeman writes over 700 articles, essays to the Saturday Review. Some of them, of course, or most of them are anonymous. because this is the method of the Saturday Review. But not only him. Stubbs is very much involved in religion, in religious debates as well. Kingsley, of course. Bryce is very much is a member of parliament later. So all of them are very much not only men of letters or writing scholarship, but are also very much involved in the world. And I would say the place of Britain here is very much important, because the whole aspect of how this kind of the division of time and how time is basically divided into certain periods or racial categories in the sense of the case of Freeman and others, is it basically is kind of clash over the Eastern question with the Ottomans is a very much reflecting the idea of time. So I would say there's a clash between the empires in the sense there's no clash, because as they see it, of course, Britain is going against the Aryan Christian notion, especially the Israeli, really basically by his sort of long support of the Ottomans, he basically goes against the whole Aryan race and Aryan Christian affinity. And they actually attack him on this, or this this group of course liberals. They attack the Israeli harshly on this, but not only him. Gladstone, of course, is also a close friend of these figures. And he also speaks about this sort of notion that, of course, in the Bulgarian Horus, against the pact with the Ottoman Empire and so on. By the way, this does not mean that once the liberals are in power, they will already change Britain's course. But what I want to say is that the politics of the days is really reflected in this kind of days of racial clashes. And Freeman, for sure, is very much involved in this kind of debates. He's a harsh critic of the Israeli and of the pact with the Ottomans. And I think that he wants to put this politics inside his history, I would say. Of course, today it's something that is forbidden, or forbidden at least on paper, because people still, of course, bring their own private ideas into their historical writing, some in a more direct way, some in a more vague way, but this still happens. But there, of course, this kind of differentiation between the themes was less apparent. History is not as professional as it, well, became to be, maybe. But I think in this sense, this really reflects Freeman's idea. And he wants basically to bring England back into the good side of history as he sees it. So he wants them to actually go harshly against the Turks. And then so he brings this kind of long delay historical divisions between the races. This is in the case of Freeman. In the case of Bryce, it's also, of course, very prominent in the sense that he was very much involved in the Eastern question. He, of course, cared very much from the 1870s for the Armenian communities in the East. And in this case, again, this idea that there's a pact of, I would say, Romano, Teutonic, Germanic constitution is something that the West, as the West, should cherish. And also, this is the place of Britain in the world, to be much more active in the sense of cherishing these sort of values as he sees them. One could say it's proto-humanitarian or proto, but of course there's a Christian affinity here, but there's, I would say, linkage between the themes. Now, a very interesting episode, just to clarify about the ideas of race and language here, is that in the case of the whole Eastern question, according to Freeman, not only him, by the way, even though, for instance, nations like the Bulgarians are of Turkish or Turinian origins, once they adopt Christianity, they became part of the Aryan race. So what's very interesting here is that sometimes Freeman sees this, you know, the independent factor is race, but sometimes the independent factor could also be religion. And this is also how he plays it into the politics of the British Empire. So for instance, who are my allies in the world? Who should I do pacts with? And one of these pacts, for instance, should be, as Freeman argues, should be with Russia against the Ottomans or Turks. So this is sort of very clear example of the, I would say, amalgamation of politics and history.
Very interesting. You're pointing to the instant question, which shows a different dimension, because there has been stuff written on Freeman, Bryce, and you know, America and the Anglo-Saxon Commonwealth, but the instant question brings different complexities. And on this, and on the one theme that you identified is this also a mixture, if you will, of ideas about Aryanism, race, and religion. And I wanted to ask you here about the uses and the understandings of Aryanism, obviously associated with Max Müller and others in the Victorian setting. In what ways do these debates on Aryanism differ from later debates on Aryanism that we find in the 20th century?
This is a very complex and good, but also very good and interesting question, I think, and it's, I would even stretch it beforehand. I mean, I would even go to William Jones in the end of the 18th century, because he's really the first one, or I would say the second one, who brings this sort of Aryan notion into the debate. But he brings it, of course, mainly through philology, basically through this Ursprache of Sanskrit that is maybe the source of everything. Now, through this sort of philological origin or language origin, somewhere in the East, meaning through India until the Caucasus, there's a whole sort of Aryan debates throughout the 19th century. Of course, Schlegel and Bob and others, and Max Müller, I would say, is another carrier, or the most known carrier of these themes. This is, of course, being debated very interestingly in the epic book of Trautmann. But not only there, and I would say that it's a very interesting debate, because what you see there is this mixture between, I would say, racial affinities and language affinities, of course, or philological affinities. The thing is this, once you find the origin of a certain language, in the case of Max Müller, the next thing will be is also to find that, or to claim that this is also an origin of the race. But what you see mainly in the 19th century is all the time this mixture between, I would say, biological understandings and, we say, more cultural, philological understandings. This is all the time a mixture there. And they're not very clear sometimes where they're going. Max Müller, for instance, is very known about the fact that he's not a very sort of racial commentator or a writer. He's not really bringing race all the way in. But I must say that in terms of the Aryans, and especially when you see it around, for instance, harsh episodes like the 1870 war, 1870-1871 war between Prussia and France, or Germany and France, there, of course, he brings sort of racial tendencies into the table. And he also has a lot of claims about racial Aryan blood and so on that actually comes to the table. So even though language is very prominent in his writings and so on, I would say that race also as a physical form, in terms of blood, also appears there. So I would not undermine, for instance, the case of Max Müller. But of course, these divisions are very, very interesting. By the way, the first one who really, so who is the dominant theme said that following the philological inquiry, that basically the source is somewhere in India, or northern India, the place of the land of the Arya, if you want. But then, for instance, in the middle of the century, I'm working now in another article about an ethnologist by the name of Robert Gordon Latham. Now, Latham, for instance, is one of the first ones, or one could claim the first one in England, to actually refute the Aryan thesis. And he claims, for instance, against Max Müller, that the Aryans are, or the Aryan language, or Sanskrit even, I would claim, frame it this way, actually begins somewhere in Lithuania. He's the founder, one of the founders of the London Ethnological Society. He's a vice president there. He's also, Latham is also the curator of the Crystal Palace. He's actually not mentioned in the book, but I would say part of the work that evolved for my book is about these figures. For instance, he's joining a figure that is mentioned in my book by the name of Crawford, also an ethnologist. Both of them actually harshly attacking everything that is German, or actually everything that is associated with Max Muller's theory. So there's a whole two circuits here evolving in the mid-century. On the one hand, Max Muller and the whole Aryan concept is really taken by figures like Freeman and so on. And on the other hand, figures like Latham and Crawford. Now, what Latham and Crawford are doing here, actually, they're trying to distance the relationship between the Europeans and the Indians. They say we are different by grade, by culture, by looks, of course. So they bring race into the table again. So they claim that Max Muller is actually, his theory is not right because the whole sort of cultural as well as racial differences cannot support a theory like this. This is one aspect of their claim. The other aspect, of course, is philological. They say a very interesting claim that is also connected to the whole Darwinian revolution. The claim is this. Once you go closer to the origin, there's more variety of species. Meaning, because there's more languages, as they claim, in Europe, a variety of languages than in northern India, then the source was in Europe and not in India, in northern India. And I think this is a fascinating debate that is actually evolving from debates that I focus on my book, on the whole Aryan question, which is the, one could say this is the ultra category or the most overarching category. That mm-hmm. One needs to understand that in this case, there's also subdivisions or inner hierarchies, if you want. So in the top of the pedestal, you have the Teutonic nations, among the Aryans, of course, according to these figures. And then you have the Celtics and the Slavs. Of course, there's a whole question, should the Celts be pulled under the Aryan race? And this is a question that has already been referred by ethnologists by the name of Pritchard, a very known ethnologist. But this is being solved, or the I would say not being solved, but the claim is that they are connected to this. But there's still a pedestal. There's still inner hierarchies. So even among the Aryans, there's inner hierarchies which are very, very important. Now, I mentioned the Celts. Beside this in question, another sort of great other is, of course, France, or the Celtic entity of France. Now, this also plays into this sort of inner Aryan hierarchies. In a different, total different triangle or pedestal, or underneath this whole Aryan triangle, or if you want hierarchy, there's the whole, one could say, Semitic races, and then Tyrrhenians. Depends which one is above the pedestal. But according to them, it's just imagine sort of a timeline of races, if you want, or pedestal of races. So it's a very sort of loaded term, I would say, and a very interesting one. And I'm still following it in the work I'm doing now, actually according also regarding the Armenians, for instance.
Yeah. Excellent. Exactly. Your book shows the complexities of talking about race in Victorian Britain. And another loaded term and loaded distinction that I think your book also illustrates and paradigmatically, and I'd like your view on this before we move on, is you know, the distinction between race and nation and understandings of nationality and of the nation that are based or not based on racial categories. And what is striking here to me is that you're making the claim, and that's also the point of an intellectual historian, rather, that certain authors use race and nation, the certain authors you write about, in different ways, depending on the context, on the audience, and on the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very good point that, again, as you start from your question, it's a loaded, another very loaded term. And of course, what's very interesting about this is, again, the theme of categories, because basically what race does is breaking national uniqueness in a sense. It brings a transnational aspect in. So it joins, instead of breaking nations, it joins nations, and it brings sort of whole nations together against other whole nations. So in this case, one could say Aryans, for instance, against Semites, but one could claim differently. It brings, for instance, the English and the Germans as nations, this is what race does, together against, for instance, the French Celts, one could claim. And this really resonates, if we spoke before on politics and history, this is really seen during the 1870-1871 war. when authors like Max Müller, for instance, write in the daily newspapers and urge the Brits, or the English in this case, to support Germany's cause as a nation, of course, because they have a certain racial affinity. So in this aspect, race is a, again, overarching category is being brought to the table in order to bring the English nation closer to the German one. So it's very, very interesting. So sometimes it breaks. So it breaks the national differences between certain nations, but actually it gives a bigger antagonism, if you want, with different nations who belong to certain other subdivisions. For instance, Celts, and let's say the Irish, for instance, in the case of the Irish, in the case of the English. What happens in the 19th century, and this is a claim being brought to the table by many other scholars before I did it, but I think it's reasonable and I follow it, is that actually English identity is English identity, deferred from, I would say, British identity is being brought up in the book of Linda Cawley and others, is being really being invented in a sense during the second half of the 9th century. And this is partly because suddenly the Irish are much more apparent, or the Irish Celts, if you want, Irish Celts and Catholics are much more there. So there's a differentiation here again of religion, Catholics versus, I would say, a certain Protestant Anglican affinity, an affinity that is also based on racial affinity, of Teutonic affinity. And it's against a different other, Irish, Catholics, and of course Celts, French Catholics, and of course Celts, and so on. So basically this has been brought to the table. One should remember, of course, and now I'm presenting this actually in another article, that the Irish categories of race were really also brought up in the public British sphere during the second half of the 9th century, especially following the famine. Because following the famine, there's a whole sort of migration from Ireland to big cities like Manchester, for instance. And what we say, the whole Fenian revolt, or the beginning of the Fenian revolt of 1860, is basically being seen much more by the English public. And suddenly they're starting to fear, I would say, their own identity. And when this happened, they're trying to reach out for a new transnational racial affinities with other nations. So it's no longer a sort of a British unity, but this would be an English-German unity against a different other. So this category is really interplaying to also politics, but also the needs of the time. I would say in the 1860s, the whole Irish problem is really getting its first or one or two really major boosts toward what will happen later to be, of course, one of the bigger problems in British politics.
Right, excellent. By way of concluding this, I was struck that towards the end of your book and your conclusions, you refer to the heated debate of the nature of Anglo-German relations in the second half of the 19th century and in the early 20th century. And I wondered, and that's another dimension that, of your book, if you wanted to say a couple of words in situating the sort of reconstruction you do with regards to, you know, the Anglo-German networks of debate, if you want to situate this discussion vis-a-vis the broader question and the heated question in scholarship on the nature of Anglo-German relations in this period.
Yes, of course. Thank you for this. Well, one could say that there is, of course, from the, as I started with Niebuhr and Arnold, Thomas Arnold today, there is a rise, of course, an emergence or the growing links already from the Napoleonic Wars between England and Germany, of course. Of course, again, they have a mutual enemy. And this has been debated, of course, in recent, but once Germany, or when Germany is not a big opponent, one should say, or a big rival in the world arena, it's still emerging there. Of course, Prussia is a big entity during the end of the 18th century, even beginning of the 19th. But later also, of course, things change. And of course, the pivot is in Austria when the Habsburg Empire. But I would say that when Germany is not a big rivalry, I would say that the English are really looking forward to promoting, of course, this notion of transnational affinity with the Germans. You see it in 1870, 1871. But even after the war, the unification of Germany, still these connections are being still promoted. Of course, and this again is being debated in research, but the change is indeed somewhere in the 1890s, beginning of 1890s, where really politics, and you see, for instance, the pact on Zanzibar and Heligoland, the island for the African colonies, and also later, there is something which is changing there, when Germany does have, of course, the whole Triptych plan, and they're getting their hand more into world politics, one would say. But what's interesting here, that even, as I stated in the book, even by the beginning or months before the opening of World War One, some of these figures from the community I'm talking about, the Anglo-German scholarship, they're still bringing to the debate of being accused of actually supporting Germany's cause. Bryce is being accused of being a philo-teuton, for instance. Now, Bryce, one should understand, he's the one who's responsible later for the British report for the German invasion to Belgium. Yeah, the horrors of Belgium, if you want. He's the one, but he's still being accused. So this affinity is very sort of embedded in British politics and goes into the war. Of course, Bryce changes very fast his notions of Germany into the war. And I'm not saying even before the war he was sort of pro-German. But these things, I would claim, are much more stronger than people tend to think. And let's take it even to the Second World War, if you want, in the notion of conclusion and so on. You know, Hitler, 1940, still believes, 1940, yeah, a year into the war, still believes. And this, I claim, is part of the whole history I'm telling here. I'm not saying there's a direct link here, but in the sense of the general notion of how he sees England, and this is also part of the distinguish, he sees them as a sister nation in a sense. And he still thinks that he could sort of bring England into his own side, either through a truce or sort of a non-aggression pact or whatever. But what I want to say is that this sort of intellectual notions of an affinity between England and Germany are very much strong, and they even surpass the animosity and, of course, the fight of World War One, and they endure into that. And by the way, for instance, one could say that the whole mixture of English and German relations is, of course, being seen in the monarchy. There's a whole issue about that. I won't develop it now. But, of course, again, these genealogical relations between the English and British monarchy, I want to say, in this case, I won't even call it an English monarchy because of the German affinity, is being, of course, developed already in the beginning of the 18th century. This, I would say, very loaded the question of Anglo-German affinity and animosity is something which is a sort of an undercurrent sometimes in the relations of both countries, also in the politics and their cultural relations even, or affinities, I would say.
Yes, indeed. And your work is a contribution to that, and also to the very, very interesting and complex interloping registers of discussion on race, nation, and historical time in 19th century. Well, Oded, thank you very much for this. Just
thank
to remind our audience again, the book is called Race, Nation, History, Anglo-German Thought in the Victorian Era. Thank you.
Thank you.